Welcome, and thank you for listening to Grace Heritage Church Audio, building a household of faith on a foundation of grace. Visit us online at graceheritage.org. Please stay tuned after the message for more information. Thank you.
We certainly are committed to education around here, aren't we? We've got 23,000 or so students in town, paying anywhere from $5,000 to $15,000 a year just for tuition to get an education at the university. And there's some of you out there that are in kindergarten through 12th grade, aren't you? And that's pretty much a full-time job, isn't it? Or it seems like it, doesn't it? We have some parents who are committed to schooling their children at home full-time. And even if you aren't, the education of our children is a major focus and effort of all of us as parents, whether we send our children to a public school or a private school or we homeschool. Professors around here with PhDs seem to be a dime a dozen, don't they? Everyone around here seems to be involved in education in some way or another. In the state of Alabama, if you look at the statistics, about 7% of the population 25 years old and older have advanced or professional degrees. But if you get a little closer to home and you look at Lee County, the percentage goes up to 13%. If you focus on the city of Auburn, 26% of the population, 25 years old and older, has an advanced or professional degree. That's an amazing percentage. Now, all of these things represent a tremendous amount of mental effort and activity. Right now, most of us are beginning a new year of school, aren't we? That's on our minds. And even if you're not involved in formal schooling, you're constantly being called upon to learn new facts and principles and ideas. Maybe you're wondering what to think about thinking. Some of you may think that education can solve most of society's problems. And others of you may fear education, thinking that it may lead to agnosticism or atheism. And after all, surveys show that the more education people have, the more likely they are to abandon belief in God. And some of you find yourself in that seemingly tiny sliver of a 74% majority who doesn't have an advanced degree. Maybe you feel a little intimidated by that. Or maybe you're just tired of people who wear their degree on their sleeve like it makes them better than other people. Well, in light of all these issues, today is an excellent time to look at what the Scriptures say and to do some hard thinking about all this strenuous mental activity that we've been called to do. And so we want to do that in the light of God's wisdom as found in the Scriptures. So if you would, turn with me to Genesis chapter 1. Now, before I read the passage, the main point that I want to communicate this morning is this. The exercise of the mind in the Lord is an honorable and worthy calling to a passionate and persevering effort. Let me say that again. The exercise of the mind in the Lord is an honorable and worthy calling to a passionate and persevering effort. Now, that sounds like I spent a lot of time thinking through that sentence, and I did. So I want to unpack that for you. I've chosen my words carefully. First, I'm speaking of the exercise of the mind here and not just formal education. I'm not just addressing students and professors here, okay? The real measure of the significance of an activity is what God thinks of it. And the Scriptures tell us that the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. So please understand that I'm talking today about any mental discipline, not just earning a diploma or degree. I'm talking to you today, even if you're not enrolled in school somewhere. Okay? So you're not allowed to check out. All right? And second of all, I say that the exercise of the mind is honorable because it calls for our respect and our admiration, and even our applause. And I say that it's worthy because it has inherent value, even if no one else notices or applauds. I also say that it calls us to a passionate effort. I mean that it's something we ought to get excited about and find pleasure in. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't mean that it's going to cause us to hoop and holler like we just scored the winning touchdown against Alabama. I've never had to call a 15-yard penalty for excessive celebration in the hallway after one of my classes. Okay? just a little different kind of thing. But hard thinking is something we ought to find deeply satisfying. I also say that it requires persevering effort. Just like physical exercise, the exercise of the mind requires hard work. I discovered that over this week as I was preparing this, because there were times when I felt like I would rather be digging ditches. It was harder work than digging ditches in some cases. And I was so tempted to go check my email or do something else that was a lot easier to do. But to develop the mind requires hard work sustained over time. And finally, I say, in the Lord. And by that I mean that the only way that our minds can be exercised meaningfully is by doing it for the Lord and in the Lord's strength. Okay? So what do the Scriptures say about this? Let's read Genesis chapter 1 and verses 27 through 31. So God created man in His own image. In the image of God He created him. Male and female He created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." And God said, "Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the heavens, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food." And it was so. And God saw everything that He had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning, the sixth day. Now, the first thing that I want us to see from this passage is this. The calling to exercise the mind is basic to what it means to be a human made in God's image. It is a part of the creation ordinance calling us to subdue the earth and rule over it. And we learn from this passage what a glorious thing it is to be a human being. We're made in God's image. That means that in some ways we are like God. We're called to reflect what He is like. One of the key callings that makes us human, that gives us our identity as God's image bearers, is the calling to subdue the earth and rule over it. And in some small way, through this, we're called to be like God in demonstrating mastery over the creation and appreciation and care for it. That's part of what it means to rule and subdue the earth. So, what was man's first act of ruling over the creation? If you look down in Genesis and you just kind of follow through the verses following this passage that I just read, you'll run into the very first act recorded for Adam. And that's in chapter 2 and verses 19 and 20. It says, "Out of the ground the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the sky and brought them to the man to see what he would call them. And whatever the man called a living creature, that was its name. The man gave names to all the cattle and to the birds of the sky and to every beast of the field, but for Adam there was not found a helper suitable for him." So we see that the very first act recorded for Adam was he named the animals. And it's clear that this was a purely mental effort, because the passage tells us that God brought the animals to him. He didn't have to go out and round them all up. He just had to name them. And I've probably said this to some of you before, but we have this children's Bible story book that shows Adam leaning up against the tree while he's naming the animals. So I know it had to be that way, of course. But clearly from this passage, it was a mental effort. It wasn't a physical effort primarily. And naming the animals involved more than just giving each one of them a label. In Hebrew thought, naming is tremendously significant. It meant attaching a label that was an appropriate description of the characteristics of the one being named. If you look over in chapter 3 and verse 20, Adam named his wife. He named her Eve. What does Eve mean? Well, Eve is a word that's derived from a Hebrew word that means life giver. So he didn't just arbitrarily think, "Oh, I think that sounds pretty," and give her a name. He picked something that was meaningful, that described who she was. So this naming that he had to do required study on his part. It required observation. He had to learn about the unique characteristics of each animal. He had to be able to distinguish the attributes that made one animal different from another in order to give each one an appropriate name. In fact, when we think about the magnitude of the task here, it really was quite a task to name all the animals. Quite a bit of mental labor was involved. It required thought and order and creativity and purpose in order to carry it out. And this was one way that he was called to display God's image, because God is a God of thought and order and creativity and purpose. And like Adam, we were made for hard thinking. And God specifically designed the creation with ruling and subduing left to do. It was, in a sense, incomplete. We can see that even in this passage, because God left the naming to Adam. I mean, after all, God was the one that made the creatures. You might think he would have named them. He just said, Adam, this is a such and such. Adam, this is a such and such. But he didn't. He left that open for Adam to do as the first act of ruling and subduing. So the creation is left open to further ruling and subduing on our part. That's God's intention. It's His design for the creation and for us to do that. There are principles left to discover. Places to go. Music to be composed. Devices to be designed. Patterns to be noticed. And beauty to be exposed. There's a job to do for each one of us. And there's great joy in doing what you were made to do, isn't there? God made us so that our minds are perfectly suited for this task. Now, most of us know Ben Strout. And if you know Ben, you know he's got a truck full of tools, doesn't he? When we went down to Slidell, he pulled out this router, and we could put paneling up and just drill a small hole in the paneling over a door frame, and he could take that router and just run it around the frame of the door, and in nothing flat, we had a perfectly cut out section where the door needed to be, or a window. It was great. And it would have taken a whole lot longer to use a saw, and it wouldn't have come out nearly as well. Well, he's also got this power screwdriver that's like nothing I've ever seen before. What it does is, to fully appreciate it, you'd have to wrestle with a really difficult screw that would take you a long time, and then you stand back and see this thing at work. And what it does is it has a very slight hammering action as the bit turns, and it keeps the screw bit from jumping out of the slot in the screw. And it's you can't fully appreciate it until you've wrestled with a difficult screw. And then you stand back and watch this thing in nothing flat just put a screw right into the wall or something like that, like it was nothing. There's just something deeply satisfying about using the right tool for the job, isn't it? It's a thing of beauty. It's like a breath of fresh air when you go from not having that tool to having that tool. In fact, sometimes after the struggle of trying to find the right tool and then finding that tool, you almost wish you could name your next child after the guy who designed it. It's just such an amazing thing. But you see, we need to think of our minds that way. Our minds are a key tool that God has given us for the ruling and subduing process. And we ought to find it deeply satisfying to use that tool for His glory. We ought to find it like a breath of fresh air and a thing of beauty. And it ought to cause us to admire our designer. It also ought to encourage us to realize that God Himself, as our designer, finds it satisfying when we use these well-designed tools for the jobs that He's given for us, for His glory. Now, is that the way you think about hard thinking? Is that the way you approach hard thinking? Or is it just a necessary evil that you have to struggle through in order to get to the really good stuff of life? Folks, as much as we're tempted to do that, Christians ought not to think that way about hard thinking. We ought to embrace it as a privilege from God to reflect His image, because that's exactly what we're doing when we think hard to His glory. Now, some of you are in school, and you're exercising your mind in a formal education program of some sort. Let me ask you this. Why are you in school? Why are you studying? Why are you doing this? Is it just because your mama told you to? Or is it because you're trying to graduate and get a higher paying job? Or is it just because you want a good grade out of the class? Well, those might all be legitimate reasons, but they're not the highest reason. They're not the best reason. They're not the reason that ought to occupy the center of your thinking. The exercise of the mind prepares you for your future calling in subduing the earth to the glory of God. And that's what ought to motivate you. That's what you ought to have at the center of your thinking. It ought to capture your imagination and call forth your highest effort. And keep in mind that God is pleased as we exercise our minds here and now, even if it may not become useful to us in the future. Okay? It's the exercise now that pleases God. God loves to see His tools used for the job that they were designed for. The second main point from this passage is that the study of God's creation, including the study of God's image bearer, man, in his being, relations, and institutions, can and should be an act of joyful worship. Verse 31 says, God saw all that He had made, and behold, it was very good. So we see that the creation is very good and worthy of our deepest intellectual effort to understand and appreciate. When we study the creation, we're studying the very handiwork of God. So whether we're learning 2 plus 2 equals 4, or we're learning how to calculate the area of a right triangle, or we're learning how to compute the singular value decomposition of a matrix, we're seeing something of the order and the logic of God's mind. When we learn the presidents of the United States, or we study the causes of the French Revolution, we're learning something about the purposes of God. When we read or examine a story or a poem, we're discovering something about the beauty of God reflected dimly in His image bearer. Now, we recognize that sin has entered the world now. It's not like it was when we read here in Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2. Sin has entered the world through Adam's rebellion, and the world now lies under a curse. It isn't the unblemished creation that it once was, sadly. But even in this state, the goodness of God and the glory of God still shine through. Okay? Psalm 19, verses 1 and 2 tell us that the heavens are telling of the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of His hands. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. Romans 1:20 says, "For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse." The creation still tells us something about God, doesn't it? If we want to get to know a painter, then what do? We study his paintings. If we want to get to know a scientist, one of the things that we might do is study his discoveries. And if you want to know our Creator better, then one of the things that you'll do is study the creation so that you can know, see something of His character that's reflected in the creation. The third point that we want to make this morning is that the exercise of the mind to study God's creation is an application of the greatest commandment. You all probably remember that Jesus was once asked, "What commandment was most important?" And He gave His response in Mark chapter 12, verse 30. "And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength." We're to love God with all our minds, according to this passage, and this includes exercising our minds for His glory. Now, does that mean sitting around doing math exercises all the time, or somehow doing brain sprints or mental stretching or something like that? And we hear the word exercise, we think of stuff like that. Or maybe because it says loving God with all your mind, that maybe we're supposed to just sit around and think deep and wonderful thoughts about God all the time. Okay? Well, what does it mean? I think we can gain some insight if we compare this to how we would love God with our strength through our body. How do you do that? How do you love God through your body? Loving God with your strength does not mean you have to be like Karen Scovato and become an Olympic archer or some other type of world-class athlete, we recognize that not many of us are called to that or equipped for it. To be honest, the closest that I'm ever going to come to being a world-class athlete is that I can do a Rubik's Cube really fast. That's it. I did it with my feet once. Maybe that, if that was a sport. That's another story. We recognize that we love God with our strength by using our bodies to their utmost capacity to obey and please God in all things. That's what it means to honor and love God with our bodies. And it's the same thing with our minds. God does not call all of us to run out and get a PhD. But He does call us all to use our mental equipment to honor Him. Now, one of the greatest blessings of our diversity as human beings is that we can love God in different ways. Your education may allow you to love God in ways that I can't ever comprehend. Maybe there's a subtle beauty in a certain type of musical instrument, and you've been trained to hear that beauty and appreciate it and love God because of it. And it just goes right past me. Or maybe you know something in some detail about chemical reactions, and you marvel at how taking these certain chemicals together and putting them together forms something that you could never have guessed what its properties would be. And because of that, you marvel at God's creativity in the creation. Or maybe you're a manager of people, and you've learned that certain ways of treating people tend to motivate them to be more reliable and more productive. And so you marvel at God's character because you see it reflected dimly in His image bearers. You see, I can't worship God the same way you can, and you can't worship God the way I can. We each have special strengths, special knowledge that we can take before the Lord and say, Lord, I'm amazed at Your creation. I'm amazed at the way You are, and You've given me this special opportunity to know this that not everybody knows because of the unique gifts and opportunities You've given me. So each one of us can honor the Lord with our minds in special ways. The fourth point that I want to make is that all real knowledge is found in Christ alone. All real knowledge is found in Christ alone? That sounds like a pretty radical statement. What does the Bible say about this? Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 7 says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction." Psalm 119:99 says, "I have more understanding than all my teachers, for Your testimonies are my meditation." John 14:6 says, Jesus said to him, "I am the way and the truth and the life." John chapter 1, 1 through 3 says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made." Now, how can we make sense out of this? Are we saying that you know more than your biology professor? No, not necessarily. We know lots of knowledgeable people who aren't Christians, don't we? In fact, if right here on campus, if we thought about some of the experts that we could find people who know more about quantum mechanics, medieval literature, economic theory, fluid dynamics, aquaculture, microbiology, and so on, than anybody in this room. And I'm sure that many of those folks don't even pretend to be Christians. So how do we respond to that in light of what the Scriptures are saying here? Well, I think there are two things that we need to say to explain that. The first one is this. The proper interpretation of facts is found in God. The proper interpretation of facts is found in God. If we don't relate every fact to God and His purposes, then we really don't understand those facts. Now, let me give you an illustration that I think might help. Let's think about an auto mechanic who's working in some really, really isolated shop somewhere. Never comes out of his shop. But he is an absolute wizard at fixing cars. He can fix anything on four wheels. He can tell you all the details of internal combustion engines, fuel pumps, water pumps, fuel injection, timing belts, all that sort of stuff. He's never seen an automotive problem he can't fix. If it's on four wheels, he can fix it. But here's the thing. He has no idea what a car is for. Okay? In his shop, he's the master. He knows more than anybody in that shop. But he's lost connection with the outside world to the real purpose of his work. He has no idea that cars are made for getting places. Now, in spite of all of his skill, I think we would say, that guy is terribly ignorant, isn't he? He doesn't have a connection to the true purposes for which he was working. In the same way, you might say, a microelectronics guru knows all about silicon and photolithography and microprocessor design. And we appreciate that. And we're really glad for what he can contribute to society with his skills. And after all, we wouldn't have our beloved cell phones if it weren't for a guy like that. And where would we be without those, right? But if he doesn't see that all these things are part of God's creation, that he's called to rule and subdue for God's glory, then he really doesn't have the kind of knowledge that ultimately matters. Okay? Now, the second response to this is to say that apart from Christ, there is a veil over all true knowledge, and only Christ can remove this veil. Romans chapter 1, verses 19 through 21 tell us, "For what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. For His invisible attributes, namely His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks to Him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened." You see, as soon as we stop acknowledging God, we start misrepresenting everything in creation. The stars that were meant to point to God's glory become some sort of self-generating or self-perpetuating field of matter, and that's it. Equations that demonstrate God's order and logic are thought to be some kind of independent, man-made truth. People who are made in God's image are seen either as expendable biological accidents or a few of them, maybe you yourself, are elevated to some kind of godlike status to take the place of the living God whose existence or centrality is denied. In those cases, we become like the auto mechanic who can fix anything but doesn't even know what a car is for. Mawson Roberts says, "However brilliant an unbeliever may be, and however he may, by God's common grace, be able to contribute to human welfare, he knows nothing as it should be known. He cannot relate his knowledge or insights to the rest of truth to use it properly. And most crucially, he cannot know God. The humblest saint has a better grasp of reality than the greatest pagan mind." See, failure to center our thinking on God is an act of high rebellion, and it's offensive to God. But God, who is rich in mercy, calls men and women, boys and girls, out of this darkness. Colossians 1:13 tells us, "He has delivered us from the domain of darkness and transferred us to the kingdom of His beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins." Folks, this is not just an academic or philosophical debate. You must be properly related to God in order to understand anything of true significance and have any true knowledge. Only Christ can reconcile you to a right relationship with God. If you're still trying to make sense of yourself or the world around you without reference to God, then you need to recognize that as a state of rebellion against God. God hates that. You're trying to be independent when He made you dependent. You're twisting the facts around you to justify your independent state. You need to turn to Christ and trust Him to lift the veil. All wisdom and all truth are rooted in Christ. And in trusting Him, you'll find that He is the truth just as He claimed to be. Now, I'd like to develop four applications of this. The first one is this. Resist the sin of anti-intellectualism. You're going, wait a minute, I don't remember that listed with greed and murder and all that. What is anti-intellectualism? Well, let me just put it in very simple terms. What I mean by anti-intellectualism is turning your brain off and being suspicious of others who don't. That's what I mean by anti-intellectualism. The Bible simply doesn't give us that option, does it? The greatest commandment includes loving God with all our minds. So where would this tendency come from? Well, in the church, I believe one place that it can come from is through a fear of the wisdom of the world. After all, the Bible has some very negative things to say about certain types of wisdom. But this is speaking of wisdom so called apart from God, not true wisdom. The Scriptures are also filled with exhortations to pursue wisdom and knowledge. What about all those intellectuals who are agnostics and atheists? Shouldn't that warn us to avoid advanced education? No, but it should warn us to beware of pride in education. You see, non-intellectuals look for non-intellectual idols, don't they? And intellectuals build intellectual idols. It's not necessarily the case that people move from unbelief to belief. They just trade their idols. They become more sophisticated in their idolatry as they grow in their education. So don't let the abuse of intelligence discourage you from its God-honoring use. The second source of this tendency to anti-intellectualism is laziness. Now, if you tend to be a little slack in your study, you may not take that too seriously. I mean, after all, it's not like murder or adultery or stealing, is it? Well, the Scriptures say that it is. Proverbs 18:9 says, "He also who is slack in his work is brother to him who destroys." Okay? Slackness is a close kin, a brother, to destroying someone's property, which is a form of stealing, isn't it? Now, to be quite honest, that's really where my primary struggle is. I'm just lazy. I really am, in a lot of ways. And when I look at it in this light, I don't want to be a stealer. I don't want to destroy someone's property. It makes me sick to think about that. When I was in high school, there were some guys who got drunk one night and went to the school and broke out almost every window in the entire school. And for weeks after that, we had to sit there listening to workmen breaking out glass around the edges and watch out for glass all over the place and try to get some schoolwork done while they were replacing all that glass. We were all pretty much disgusted by what they had done. It was about the most senseless act of destruction that I've witnessed personally. I've certainly read about things far worse than that, but that was something I saw up close and personal. But you know, when I'm lazy at exercising my mind, I'm just like those guys who went out and broke all those windows in a drunken rage. The Lord detests laziness in our mental efforts. The second application is this. Cultivate higher motives in your learning than a good GPA. It's not bad to have a good GPA. It's just not the highest motive. Is your self-esteem wrapped up in having a good GPA or in having done well on the last test that you took? Maybe your big goal is to have your child making the honor roll, and that's everything for you. God calls us to a much higher goal and a much bigger vision than those sorts of things. We are His image bearers. God, the God of glory. And every fact rightly understood ought to point us to God. Knowing God and enjoying Him is our highest conceivable goal. And even in our education, we should be pursuing that. So find delight and recognize God's presence and pleasure as you exercise your mind. Parents, make sure you don't lose sight of that goal as you're teaching your children or as you're encouraging them to excellence in their schoolwork. The way you encourage them tells them everything about what's most valuable to you about their exercise of their minds. And children, You're the ones that are learning. Make sure you're learning because God has called you to it. Because God's given you a mind to learn. Okay? And when you get tempted to say, oh, this is getting too hard, I got to go pull out my Xbox. That's probably the point right there where you need to remind yourselves that thinking hard is good, is pleasurable for God's glory, and keep on going. The third application is to see the connection between life and knowledge. You see, if God is the author of all knowledge, then we should be able to find connections and principles that hold a discipline together. We should also find connections between and among different disciplines, because God is the author of all of them. It's the same God behind them all. And we should find ways in which all disciplines point to God. Let's look for these things. Let's find these connections. And let's also not forget that there's a connection between knowledge and character. After all, the central purpose of all knowledge is to point us to God. And so we cannot truly know God while remaining in a state of disobedience. Jesus said, if you hold to my teaching, you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. The fourth application is this: recognize the opportunity to glorify God with your mind and impact the world around you. And I don't think I could do any better than just reading to you the account of Daniel and his friends in the book of Daniel. The Israelites had been taken into captivity and were now in Babylon. And the king was looking for some youths to serve in his court. And in Daniel chapter 1, we're given this account. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles, youths in whom was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had ability for serving in the king's court. And he ordered him to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. Now, among them from the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And then we go down in verse 17, and it says, as for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. Then at the end of the days, which the king had specified for presenting them, the commander of the officials presented them before Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and out of them all, not one was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's personal service. As for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in all his realm. Now that ought to motivate us to the exercise of the mind. That example. What a testimony to hard thinking done for the glory of God and for the good of those around us. May we also be found faithful the way Daniel and his friends were. And beginning or continuing this very week, may we exercise our minds in the Lord as an honorable and worthy calling to a passionate and persevering effort. Let's just take a few moments now to meditate before the Lord and respond to His Word.
Thank you for listening. Grace Heritage Church meets in Auburn, Alabama. Services are held at 9:30 a.m. on Sunday morning at the Best Western on the corner of College and University.